Great. I'm going to start. Water. Water is good. Today, we shall have a nice little conversation about network teaming and multi-channel solutions that exist in the box. Let me repeat that. In the box. Yes, finally, in the box for being able to have another layer of resilient infrastructure that you can rely upon and also be able to aggregate bandwidth for even better performance should your applications and workloads require it. And the interesting thing is that this actually is two pieces to this particular section. One is talking about NIC teaming, and the other one is about SMB multi-channel solutions and how it works. I am once again challenged by this particular session because I do not have the budget or the strength or the stamina to be able to carry a rack full of servers and network switches with me while I go around from place to place. And the demo architecture infrastructure that we have access to here at the private cloud has already been set up, and they refused to let me muck around with the cables and stuff like that for obviously very good reasons, to be able to go off and do some stuff on the physical hardware. And so it'll be an interesting thing that comes up to see how this works for NIC teaming and multi-channel solutions. Because you're all here, I have to assume that you've had an experience with NIC teaming before. If you've used NIC teaming before, put up your hand. Absolutely everybody in the room. Keep your hands up, keep your hands up, everyone keep your hands up. Keep your hands up if you would recommend NIC teaming to your friends. Almost everybody puts their hands down. A couple leave it up. So good. I'm glad to hear you have some positive experiences with NIC teaming. That is always good to have, especially first thing in the morning. Now, I do have my disclaimer once again that being a Canadian, and you are now in the Canadian room of 1A, we have some maple syrup to give away for some questions, as well as some fantastically beautiful blue and black and red T-shirts should you decide to ask some questions. There'll be plenty of time for questions to talk about stuff. But the maple syrup that you will be receiving is, in fact, clean. It is not part of the tainted maple syrup scandal from 2 weeks ago in Canada, where thieves broke into and stole 30 million liters of maple syrup from the Canadian Maple Syrup Reserve in Quebec. What are you going to do with 30 million liters? You're going to corner the market, my friend. So if you guys see discounted maple syrup in Australia, it wasn't me. Wasn't me. I mentioned this one here, which is actually kind of funny, because a friend of mine told me later on last week, after I publicized this one and shared it with you, there was actually a massive bacon theft that happened in the States. And, you know, different people, different cultures have different reserves of different solutions. You know, the United States is oil. I didn't know they had a bacon reserve, but apparently they do. Vegemite reserve is safe. Thank you very much, Peter. Now, the funny thing is that I'm just waiting for the guy that's going to be attacking the poultry industry now to be able to have eggs and bacon and maple syrup, and basically we're going to call these guys the breakfast bandits. Anyway, at some point, if you see it in the news, it wasn't me. We're all good up here. We're talking about Windows Server 2012. You guys heard the marketing pitch at the very beginning of all this week, where the tagline currently is from the cloud up. Behind our planning and design phase for Server 2012, we looked at all the stuff that we've been doing in the very large data centers that we have running. Yes, Microsoft is not just a software company. We also run some of the most massively scalable data centers out there, providing such lovely services as Hotmail, as Azure, as Xbox Live, as yada, 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 you get to see. All sorts of different sort of stuff, but we're bringing that sort of stuff into the operating system you can use regardless of the size of your environment. So this applies to small, medium business. This applies to individual workstations as well. But if you had a choice in these ones here, I'm just kind of curious. NIC teaming provides a background for a little bit of overview of what we're going to be covering, how it works, and some demo and SMB multi-channel as well. But I'm curious to find out, who uses NIC teaming for aggregation and throughput bandwidth stuff? They want more juice into their servers. Put up your hands. It's about, it's just a little bit over 50% right now. Who uses it for redundancy? About 60%. I don't know how 50% and 60% work together to equal 100. So I'm assuming that people that also have aggregation also use it for redundancy, which is good to know. Both SMB multi-channel and NIC teaming provide you the ability to aggregate bandwidth and get better throughput to your systems. And they also provide you with a level of fault tolerance with being able to handle and sustain failures. Some of the stuff that we're talking about is also around, again, from the cloud up, looking at when we design systems to design them in such a way that they are designed that the underlying systems underneath them, the physical network or whichever, is inherently going to fail and also could be considered human error as well, as you'll see in just a moment. So the NIC team and SMB multi-channel, they have in channel in common, basically reliability is simply job one to make it work. You want to be able to have multiple paths and multiple NICs and multiple cables into your environment. NIC teaming basically gives you protection against the failures in the host is one side of things. SMB multi-channel gives you some multi-path protections to be able to get access to that data where you get it. And then also more bandwidth is also good as well. They've generally worked together where it's there. Now, in your data centers, everyone here says they've used NIC teaming in the past in some shape, way, shape, or form. What do you think is the number one most common failure in data centers these days? Human error. Human error. That's a bit too general. That's good. Is it CPU overheating? Is it cooling issues? Drive failures? What? Got some people nodding. What do you say, Peter? Drive failure? No, sorry. It's not. Human error. To elaborate on human error, whoever said that, what do you think it is with human error? Thank you. People pulling cables. I had a picture, but they made me remove it because I didn't have the copyright access to it, of probably one of the most scary pictures I've ever seen of a data center, where you had rows upon rows of racks of systems, and you look in the back of them, you guys know what the back of racks look like, right? And there's the really nice, manicured, hand-tied, individually wrapped, and everything's all done and structured and gorgeous, and that's when the server moves in. And then there's the picture of the exact same server rack about a year later, where all the spaghetti mess of cables is coming out of the back. And human error is, no one's using this port. I'll just use this port and plug my other server into it, and all of a sudden, Hotmail is down or something like that. human error. Changing network cables, changing port settings, that sort of stuff is actually one of the things that is one of the biggest problems in data centers. And that's why there's such an important emphasis on change control and processes used inside data centers. And so generally speaking, it's all this cable isn't being used. That's one of the biggest areas. NICs tend to be more reliable on the underlying structure of what they are these days. They're also becoming quite commodity-based. They're upping the scale limits. When I got started in this industry, one of my jobs, my very first jobs, was actually ripping out ARCNET and replacing it with 10 base T cables. Or is it 10 base 2? I forget. The Terminators at the end of the line? 10 base 2, yes. 10 base T was luxury. You got that the next year. Now you're looking at standard interfaces on servers in the HP rack, the Gen 8s, that are 10 gigabit adapters that are on those things. And then we talk about storage networks, and then you actually can go even higher. So how do you make something resilient and just work across the board with all the different technologies coming down the pipe to work with all these different technologies? So enough preamble. Let's dive into a little bit more of the meat here with some NIC teaming background and what is changed and what has not changed from what's out there. So NIC teaming, a little bit of background, a little bit of history. People also call this NIC bonding, to be able to bond a bunch of different NICs together, to be able to have aggregate bandwidth. We're using LBFO, or load balancing and failover, is another terminology people end up using. There's a bunch of different things that are out there. Basically, you're simply taking two or more network adapters so that the software above the team, so the higher level stuff inside the stack, perceives it as a single interface. And then it will choose, based on whatever protocols you're using, or whatever software you're using, it'll choose whichever NIC is the best, and if one fails, it'll fail over the other one if you have that set up, to give you a level of protection and bandwidth aggregation across the board. Now, most of you said that you would have used it in the past, but then a very big chunk of you said that you wouldn't recommend it to your friends. And I'm curious, why wouldn't you recommend NIC teaming to your friends? Nice. Not many people configure the switches correctly. What else? Compatibility of software. No support in the OS. You have to worry about your support from the NIC driver manufacturers. Disparate configuration utilities to get things to work. Inconsistency between companies. You mean you can't just take like a Intel class server NIC and then combine that with an HP NIC and combine that one there with the Realtek device? Blasphemy. Yes. Because it was not part of the OS, you had to rely on third-party drivers, third-party manufacturers, to go through and to engineer their network stack and drivers before you're able to go off and use those with the different workloads. And then even the workloads may or may not support it, some of them more famously than others, that are in there. So, absolutely, those are some of the main reasons, and you'll be happy to know, because you're here, that we've solved those issues that are out there. Another thing that we can use NIC teaming for that comes into play, and this is what most people end up using NIC teaming for as well, is the ability to go off and do VLAN traffic segregation when it comes inside the network. So you can basically go in and ensure that the proper VLANs come into your environment, and then they get routed in and through to the rest of your organization. So the rest of your virtualization infrastructure or to the rest of your applications that are in there. So I'm telling you now, it's in the box and that it's available. It is now basically fully integrated into the Microsoft networking stack from the ground up to support whatever workload you have on top of it. And it is absolutely vendor agnostic. You can literally take and mix and match the vendors inside your NICs. I had a little small quiet golf clap over there from somebody. But yes, you absolutely totally can start mixing and matching your different things. That's in there. It lets you configure your teams to meet your needs, how you want to do it. The nice thing about this is obviously we're using our approach of server manager as the way to be able to configure it. There are no weird third-party apps and drivers you have to go off and install to make it work. The best thing about this is probably the second bullet point up from the bottom. Fully supported from calling Microsoft support. That's a clap right there. So you can literally configure a NIC team for multiple vendors, have it all working inside your system. Something's going wrong and flaky. You call up tech support, and Microsoft support goes in and says, "No, please remove your NIC. Please remove NIC teaming. I'm running Server 2012." Oh, okay. Well, in that case, it's included. It's there. It works from the ground up. Now, first caveat: when you're doing it, I like how one gentleman up there chuckled. First caveat. Here's the first caveat: you have to remove all the other third-party NIC drive, third-party NIC teaming software solutions before you use the Server 2012 ones. So basically, you just need to make sure you have the drivers for the NICs, and they're all supported. They're all Windows Server 2012 certified hardware, and Server 2012 certified NIC drivers, which obviously they should be, and you're good to go. I'm going to show you a demonstration that is not Windows certified. It does work. However, it's for emphasis, just to show you how easy it is a little bit later on. So it's fully supported. There's no need of getting told you have to remove it with a PSS support call. And the best part is it's so easy. So let's look at some architecture for this, some terminology. So the vocabulary behind this is basically that you've got the top of the stack, the actual team is in the middle, and then the members down at the bottom. So the top of the stack is basically known as your team members. We also call them TNICs for team network interfaces. At the front. That's what you end up creating and exposed to the outside world and exposed to the applications that are out there. The team itself, and then finally the individual team members or network adapters are at the bottom. You can very easily figure this all out to see what's involved. Are you talking about a TNIC or are you talking about the network adapter? By using some PowerShell commands if you wanted to. Now, I will say that we actually did a good job, and such a good job, in fact, with their interfaces that most people actually don't like to use the PowerShell interface. They prefer the GUI interface because it literally is so simple. But you can do this all with PowerShell. The other neat thing about this as well is you can manage this all 100% remotely. I can literally create a NIC team from my Windows 8 console running RSAT pointed to a rack of servers in Chicago, and make a NIC team across the wire using PowerShell remotely on that guy to be able to make it work. So it's all remoting and all supported as well. So Now, the gentleman up at the top was saying that there were some issues with configuration and also some issues possibly with having switches incorrectly configured and stuff like that as well. Let's take a look and see a little bit about this connection modes, because this is all stuff that you may or may not be aware. A lot of people, when they go off and they configure NIC teams with the software current editions for what you'd be using, they just basically choose whatever worked for them and then hope they got the best performance. We're going to dive down into different types of modes for switch connected modes and then link aggregation as well, to kind of figure out what makes the most sense for your architectural designs. So basically there's two different types of modes that you're working with. There's either a switch independent mode, where it requires absolutely no configuration at the network layers on the switches you're plugging into. You just have to be plugged inside the same subnet. And it basically will protect you against individual switch failures, because it simply is a network connection, that's all it is. Those are the easiest ones to worry about. That's called switch independent. Now when you make a switch dependent infrastructure, those ones there generally are known as generic or static teams when you create them. And the intelligence is done at the switch layer. And it controls, for the most part, when traffic comes in from the network, which of the interfaces on the team it should be going to, as opposed to the previous one, which is independent, where the OS decides how to handle that inbound or outbound traffic based on how you have it set up and configured. And so when you're working with dependent switch modes, basically you have to make sure that all your switches are configured correctly, including other switches that your NICs are plugged into. In other words, adjacent switches as well. They have to be worried with. So we're going to be able to work both with switch independent teams and also switch dependent teams when we're talking about this. Now, as far as the load, how do we handle the load on these individual teams? Well, there's basically two different ways you can handle this, and it's basically going to be either an address hash or it's going to be a Hyper-V port if we're talking about virtualization. Address hashing basically works with the preference being at the highest level and working its way down for the lowest level. Highest level means you're going to be working with what's known as a four-tuple hash, which requires that you have visibility and knowledge of what's going on at the TCP port and at the UDP port level. If it can't see that traffic as far as what's going on, as far as the driver's concerned, it's going to fall down to a two-tuple hash, where it's simply using the IP address information. And if it can't work at that level, it goes down to the lowest level, which is simply MAC address hashing for what's there. You can actually see which ones you're using with the command lines to be able to see what's involved. The good part is you don't really need to know this level of granular detail, but it is exposed if it's of interest to you. And finally, Hyper-V port really is only used if you're using Hyper-V, obviously. If you're not, you're basically going to be kind of defeating the whole purpose of NIC teaming, other than the fact you're going to have a standby, because it's going to direct all the traffic through one of those NICs, through a single port. So basically, it hashes the port number on the Hyper-V switch within Hyper-V Manager that all the traffic is going through, and it allows you to basically go in and isolate traffic through individual NICs for individual VMs, but then you're capped at performance. So this kind of gives you a little table, looks like this. We'll see this table a couple of times. Let me go into detail what this table actually means. But as you can see, you got two categories as far as your rows are concerned, switch independent and switch dependent. Each of them have their advantages and disadvantages. And then you have the load distribution, which is either going to be an address hashing or it's going to be a Hyper-V port. And you can see the slight differences between each one of those in this table is coming up. So enough about the architecture. What does it look like? Pretty simple. You right mouse click in the server in question, if you're doing the GUI interface. The tool of choice is Server Manager. And then there's a pop-up option that says NIC Teaming. Even if you only have one NIC, it still comes up. And then when you do that, this little interface comes up and it shows you all available servers and all available NICs that you're looking at. And then if any teams currently exist. We're able to then go in and to pull up the details of the individual team and the properties. And you can see down under additional properties the type of teaming mode you're using, either switch dependent or switch independent. And then the load balancing algorithm you're using, address hashing, which is the automatic cascading one down and is in the ways that it works. Or Hyper-V ports, which should only be used if you're using virtualization as your workload. And then you also have the ability to identify standby adapters. And then lastly, if you really are a glutton for punishment, you can go through and do a very simple get net LBFO, not LMFAO, LBFO team, and it tells you the name of the team, the NICs that are involved, what it's called, is it switch independent, and then what level of algorithm are you using, and is it up or is it down? That's literally all there is to it. Let me show you this, as opposed to just talking about it, because it is kind of cool to look at, for how to set it up. I'll switch over to my screen in just one second when I've got it properly established. Okay, Server Manager. This is my box that I was using the other night, actually, for my REFS demos. It's my WSUS box. You can see here that it has a bunch of different IP addresses right up at the top. And for some reason, my Zoomit's not working, so bear with me for one moment. I gotta have Zoomit. Of course, it's not there. So let's get it from here. Come on. There we go. Very simple. You can see one and then a bunch of other guys. So what I've done is basically, to be able to do this demo, I've added in four NICs in total. One of them I signed with a static IP address, which is Ethernet 0, or Ethernet, just the word Ethernet for the name. And then I added in three other ones. Those three other ones are Ethernet 1, 2, and 3. Or maybe it's 2, 3, 4. But either way, they got an address through DHCP, so you guys can actually see them. You would normally go in and assign the physical address of these guys, obviously. But they're currently set up as 1, 2, 3. On my system. Literally, right mouse click on this guy here, configure NIC teaming. And this interface comes up. It's not technically a part of Server Manager anymore. It's basically launched off a tool. But it looks very Server Manager-esque for what it does. And if I take a look here, I've got my four NICs that are visible. Two, three, and four, the ones I'm going to be making my team with. I'm not going to be making my team with number one. Anyone know why? Static address. I would lose my remote desktop connection, and basically you guys wouldn't be able to see the demo anymore. So I'm going to use just two, three, and four to be able to make it. Very simple to do this. Select these guys. Select multi-select. Right mouse click, add to a team. Let's call this guy Gold Coast Team. Two of them are selected. Down below for advanced properties, if I wanted to, I can switch it up to switch independent or switch dependent. The reason why it's not giving me the ability to make any changes here is because, these are virtual NIC adapters. I don't have any switching hardware that I'm actually really plugged into, so pretend I could drop down box and change something here, but I can't. And then same thing over here. I don't have the ability to change my individual algorithm that's being used. It's simply address hash. It's going to start at 4-tuple, then down to 2-tuple, and down to MAC addressing to be able to try to do any kind of it. And then I can identify any standby adapters. And then finally, a default interface is going to be called default VLAN for connections in. Hit OK. It goes in and brings me up. I now have a team of two NICs. Coming back over here to Server Manager, doing a refresh on this guy. Notice that I now look like I have three NICs because I have one out of a team with a hard-coded .40. I've got one in the team, or sorry, two of them in the team, which have one address now. And then finally, I have one that's still there as a spare. The reason why I still have one there as a spare is because I wanted to show you how easy it is to say, looking at my performance and my bandwidth issues, I'm now taking a look and seeing that I have some constraints taking place. I want to go in and add another NIC into that team. What do? I go in and choose properties of the team. I add in my NIC. I hit OK. Boom. I now have a third NIC in my team. Go back over to Server Manager. Hit the refresh. And I can now see 1.8, the address never changed. Services were still continuing to work on that NIC. It inserted the NIC into that particular team, and things kept on going. I haven't switched out to any separate programs. It's integrated in the operating system. It, in this case, is aggregating together three virtual NICs very, very fast. And basically, I'm done with Nick teaming. That's how easy it is to go off and to make stuff. One thing I can do is I can go ahead and identify failovers on my systems. For team interfaces, you can see here, Gold Coast team, it's all good. Properties of the team. If I want to make this guy into a failover, let's go in and take him out. And actually, you know what? I forgot. I can't actually go in and change that properties once I've made them. At creation, you have to identify your failover. So I apologize for that. I thought I could just go in and add the nick in and say, this guy's my failover. When you create the default nick at the very beginning, that's when you have to identify if you want to have some guys as failover. So I'd have to go in and actually delete this team and then identify one as the failover and then bring him back up again. But you can see how easy it is to go in and to make the changes, switch independent, address hashing mode. I've got currently two adapters on there, and I'm good to go. One thing that I will mention as well, if I take a look at this, because I want to have this for my next demo, I'm going to add him in. So he's all good. Now that he's there, when I do my next demo on SMB multipath and how that all works and using NickTeaming as well, we'll see some cool stuff with interfaces and traffic. So let me bring up my task manager here under performance. And you'll see here that I've got one guy called the Gold Coast team. And I've also got the other guy, which is my regular Ethernet adapter of 0.40 for two different NICs that's on there. I'll keep him up for my next demo coming up in just a moment. Wasn't that exciting? Yay, it's all there, it all works. Interfaces, very simple, easy to use. Let's dive down to the architecture a bit more for which one you would end up using from an architectural perspective for your different choices. Remember that four quadrants that we had before, this guy right here? So first of all, talking about address hashing and switch independent. Think of it basically try to see the easiest way to explain this one. One lane of traffic that's going to be coming into your environment, and then four or five lanes of traffic leaving your environment as far as bandwidth is concerned, with the number of cars you can run on your highways. This is very good, basically, for when you're using high download information out, so basically load and aggregating your load across the board. File servers that are doing massive transfers, IIS workloads that are trying to do massive amounts of stuff out to your individual systems. Very simple to set this guy up. It's basically used when you want to have native teaming, where you are concerned about having the proper configurations done on your individual switches correctly, and you want to make sure that the workload has the maximum output into the environment. The reason why it only has one input that comes in is because it's using IP address information, a MAC address. There's only one MAC address and one IP address visible to that team. So when it comes in, basically, the default NIC is the one that's going to be taking the inbound, unless, of course, it fails over. And the outbound basically goes out and uses the link aggregate's bandwidth across all four, all five, all ten interfaces that's out there. So this one here, big workloads on your servers, file server information, web server information, lots and lots of stuff that has to go out off a single box. When we start talking about Hyper-V ports, this is again from a virtualization perspective, where you want to go in and to have ability to control the traffic coming through your Hyper-V switch. Now with this, every single VM is basically going to be associated with a single NIC from an optimized throughput perspective. And you do your configuration of which NICs to go to which VMs through the Hyper-V switch manager interfaces. Now this generally works with very good when the number of VMs far exceed the number of NICs on your servers, which generally is the case for very large implementations for consolidation. It also is a way that you can go in and deal with the fact that you're only ever going to have one NIC possible throughput requirements for a single virtual machine. You're not going to have to worry about exceeding that bandwidth on that single box. So again, as from looking at this from a physical hardware perspective on my NIC teaming solution, I'm not able to show this because I'm already within the virtualized environment, so I can't actually show what this looks like. But Hyper-V switch, very, very simple to configure and have it go from there. When you start getting into switch dependent modes, otherwise known as SI for switch, for switch dependent, and then AH for address hashing, this time it's not the individual server that decides how to get the bandwidth out and then only have one path coming in. This time, the switch basically decides. When the traffic comes into the switch, it needs to go down to the individual interfaces. The switch is able to go in to determine which interface it needs to direct the traffic to when it goes out. Very simple. The downside of this particular level here is the fact that you don't have any control of it within the operating system. The switch has to do it. The way this is actually quite good is if you have a very low-level architecture infrastructure, you understand what your switching hardware is capable of, and you want to make sure that you're absolutely tweaking out every single possible option for getting multiple inbounds and matching it correctly out to your outbound traffic. So generally, this is good for performance. Now, in this case, this is also useful if you wanted to go through and if you knew that a particular virtual machine that's running wants to have more bandwidth coming into it than what a single NIC can be able to afford. You have to do it at the switch level like this to be able to do it. Now, the last one is Hyper-V port with switch dependent. This is generally something you can do. However, the danger with this one here is that, or not danger, the thing with this one here is basically if you want to receive the data, it's going to be coming in on all ports. Inbound traffic is going to be distributed by the switch itself, again, the hardware level switch. Hyper-V teaming, and when VMs are going to be exceeding the inbound bandwidth and part of team members, and when you want to go in and handle some different layers of fault tolerance for when your switches, if you have independent switches, if your switches end up having to go down, you want to be able to make sure things can still get in, this is one other option. Not seen all that much. Generally, you're going to be using the switch independent mode for the most part. Again, unless the criteria is you have one VM that's going to have more bandwidth coming in than one the single NIC is able to provide. So now with the team interfaces, the TNICs, remember we talked about VLAN segregation, basically identifying what traffic's coming in. Now, there's something, if you notice when I made that switch, it was set up with a default, for default mode. Now, when you start doing stuff at the VLAN interfaces to be able to identify which traffic's going into which NIC interface, you'll end up with a situation where possibly you have all VLAN traffic for VLAN number 42 come in on this TNIC interface to go into my team to segregate it out, and then you have all leftover stuff come in through the other guys to go in. That's a good way to work. However, one cautionary note is that if you have the middle configuration where you have individual VLANs identified for each of your interfaces, your TNICs, there is no catch-all if you identify every single one, in which case you have this magical black hole that your data will go into, which is very difficult to track unless you remember the fact that you took off your default. And the cautionary note that I have for you is if you start doing this, and you happen to have the leftmost, the rightmost option configured. Be aware of that. Is because even, I'm completely backwards here. Leftmost, what I was trying to say. Number 42. If you start doing this one here with a virtualized environment in Hyper-V, and you actually assign inside your machines, you can do Hyper-V, you can do VLANs inside your network interfaces in Hyper-V switch. If you don't tell your other administrators that you have at the external to hypervisor layer said all 42 VLAN traffic go through this interface, and then someone inside your virtualized infrastructure goes in and also assigns VLAN number 42 to a particular NIC within Hyper-V, magically all network traffic will cease to that individual system inside the virtualized environment because it won't get to it because the NIC team will basically suck it in with 42 VLAN before it gets up inside the virtual machine. So be aware of that when you start to do a segregation or a discombobulation of your VLAN traffic and sorting it out by individual TNIC interfaces. So be aware of that. I've seen it happen before. Now with the team interface, a team creation, when it's created for the very first time, it basically looks like one team interface. I'll show you what that looked like. You are able to go in and name it whatever you like. You can rename it on the fly if you wanted to with a rename slash netadapter commandlet. The team interface shows up with a get netadapter output, and generally the very first team interface is set up to have that default mode in your system. Now some additional stuff about this. When you create it, the initial team is the one that's going to be looking after your VLAN mode team interfaces to be able to segregate traffic out. As I mentioned, it's a violation of Hyper-V rules to have more than one team interface in a team that's bound to your Hyper-V switch, do all the stuff inside the Hyper-V switch itself. And then lastly, any team with one member or one NIC can also be created. The only reason why you would do this is basically to go in and to have some level of tagging going on for your VLANs. It has absolutely no performance changes as far as failure is concerned to have one interface at the back end. Now, one thing I wanted to show you, should I do that now? No, I'm going to save that. Hang on a second. So far, I've shown you how to do this with virtual interfaces. What types of interfaces can you actually go ahead and do this with? As I mentioned, they have to have the Windows logo requirements from a driver perspective. Teaming for non-Ethernet, so in other words, InfiniBand, Wi-Fi, wide area network, WANs, that sort of stuff, is absolutely not supported. They will not show up in the teaming interface to be able to do anything with. And don't go in and make a team interface or a TNIC and then try to team another TNIC on top of that. Doesn't work. Likewise as well, don't make your teams on the third-party drivers to make it look like one NIC and then make a team of those guys using the OS level. You're gaining nothing except for confusion that's out there. So don't do that. Other thing as well is obviously when we're doing all this different types of NIC teaming, it should be said, and assuming you guys know this, you don't plug your interfaces that are part of the team into separate subnets. They all go inside the same subnet. Otherwise, you end up having some very strange things that go on to your system. Team members are active or standby. I showed you them all being active that's in there for being able to handle the load. You can go in if you wanted to and also make a team within a virtual machine. Generally, this is going to be done if you're doing some cool stuff with SRIOV if you wanted to, but it does require that you configure the switch appropriately to be able to do this. I've shown you the management interface, PowerShell access to it as well, and then finally, what is actually going off and supporting it. Now, for my second part of a demo, what I want to show you is, I showed this to you in a virtualized environment before. This is my actual physical server, that's my laptop right here. And I'm like, okay, well, how can I can show the management interface to how to be able to do this, but how do I make it a bit more real to be able to show how this all works? So if I look at my interfaces right now, I have one Ethernet interface, which is an actual interface. It is a Intel onboard physical NIC over here on my left hand, my right, your left, right here, this yellow cable. It's plugged into there. These guys are all part of the Hyper-V switch, so basically they're not real. This is wireless, which is not possible, so you basically can cross that guy out. And then this here is a loopback adapter that is simply a software piece of a NIC software that I use to remote into my my machines to give you a better experience to look at my machines as opposed to only using the Hyper-V client. What I have here is a $25 USB gigabit adapter plugged into the same network as this guy. And this is a server OS, and I thought that I would go in and make a team and let's see how that works. I don't recommend this for your enterprise deployments, by the way. Not a good idea. Plugging it in. Notice the Belkin super high-end $35 adapter is gigabit. It's slowly coming up. Notice that they are both plugged into the same network. And therefore, if I go into my server manager interface, right mouse click on my server. Okay, I'm doing it on the same box, but you know, bear with me here. Configure NIC teaming. This is my server, it's up and working, it's physical. I have my two systems, and then I have my fake ones, which are my Hyper-V switches. Notice my wireless cards can show up in here automatically, and neither does my loopback adapter, because they're not real adapters, so basically it filters them out. I literally take these two NICs, just to see here what my interfaces are. I can see here that I've got an interface on 1044 4 230. I have another one over here, 1044 4 232. Those are my two live NICs that are plugged in right now. All right, mouse click, add to new team. Team name is called Real Demo. I'm looking. I do have the ability to change stuff. However, I'm not going to change anything because I don't know what the switching infrastructure is I'm talking to in the back. I'm just going to say, let's take the defaults and go ahead and make this. Hit OK. Notice it gives me an error, a fault message, disconnected. It has to reinitialize the drivers. Come back in again. Boom. My team is now made. If I now go ahead and do an ipconfig once again on this guy and look up, I have one that is called Real Demo, and I have an IP address that is set up as 10.44.4.232, and it is up and working. If I go into my task manager to be able to show you this, this is my fake, this is my fake, my fake, my fake, my not connected, my fake. Oh, there's my real one right there for my system, for Real Demo. On the fly, added two NICs into it. One of them is a USB NIC by Belkin, and the other one is the built-in Intel one. Two completely different manufacturers that probably never talked to each other before from a perspective of making NIC drivers to make them all work, and it's just working on server and done. No weird interfaces. Fully supported if I actually went. Actually, I'd be interested to see if they will be. Yeah? Well, the other interesting thing, let's go down to a lower level bit level. This is a 64-bit driver over here. This is a 32-bit driver that's installed. I just downloaded this morning. It's a 32-bit driver for my NIC. Different manufacturers, different levels of drivers, and they're still working inside the same NIC, and they're at the same speed. That's a clap. You can clap on that. Whew. I literally just made that demo about 10 minutes before you guys walked in the room. Trying to find drivers for that Belkin was not easy to make it work. Oh, yeah. So I guess the last part of that particular demo I wanted to show you, I forgot about this. There's my two guys. My switch is working. Everything's all fine. Human error. Rick hasn't really had more than half of his cup of coffee in here. He's working away in the system, and all of a sudden, oops, I just disconnected my network cable because it must not be used. Still working. Still there. I don't know if you guys remember the IP address. 232. Still there. That just eliminated the biggest hazard to your data center. Rick Claus walking in and touching your cabling. That's in there. Absolutely still working. It's all still good. Obviously, if magically this guy comes back in again, this guy will realize he's now back. Boom, back to green, and he's all happy again. And it's all, once again, still the same thing from a network address perspective of 232. Very cool stuff. NIC teaming in the box. Pull the other one out? That's a little harder. I can pull out the cable. I can't really actually yank out the interface on my laptop while it's live. Building cloud-like scalability and independence, resilience infrastructure using the stuff that you happen to have. Someone was a Rick with a red shirt on. Was that you? Good question. In iSCSI applications, I was getting to that with this slide up here, but more so from an RDMA hardware accelerated perspective for what's involved. Generally speaking, as long as you have networking connectivity and you can talk to it, you're good. It's different for talking for multipath I/O. That's coming up. But as long as the OS sees it, it's going to be fully supported because all workloads that are there. Take a look at this for 1 second, though. There's the red box in the middle there, the TCP offload and RDMA. The reasons why those are not supported with NIC teaming is because that's technology that goes and bypasses to go directly and offload workload processes onto the hardware itself. So that is not supported with NIC teaming because it doesn't happen to the software. It's down to the hardware itself. And then SRIOV stuff is only really within a virtual machine for VMs. Now, the last thing I didn't talk about as of yet, I did mention this works with other vendors, mixed match vendors, as you just saw, mixed match drivers, 32-bit and 64-bit drivers. I'm pretty sure the support team and the product team are not going to be too happy that I showed you a 32 and 64-bit working together. I wouldn't exactly call that a stable environment for enterprise. You can have 32 NICs in a single team from a throughput for a single box. If you can cram that many NICs inside your servers, you can have 32 NICs in a team. And you can have 32 team interfaces that are in there, and basically a maximum of 32 teams per server. So you've got a whole world of scalability that's out there. Now, obviously, when it says due to other system constraints, that really is physical. Can you fit that many NICs inside of your servers? I don't expect to all of a sudden see you guys cascading USB 3 hubs off the back of your servers and going with USB Ethernet cards. Do we look at 32? Don't do that. The product team will kill me if you think that you're able to have that supported. So you've seen my demo in NIC teaming, and that's basically going to put NIC teaming to bed and talk about the second part of this section, which is about SMB multi-channel stuff. So SMB multi-channel. Now, there was a whole session on SMB 3 that happened yesterday. You should have gone and reviewed that session prior to this one, because that's where all the meat is. This is simply talking about the multi-channel capabilities of SMB 3 and what you can do with it. So SMB multi-channel, basically, if you think about this in a simple form, means that you're able to have multiple connections for an SMB session, provided your client supports SMB 3 and your server supports SMB 3. The neat thing about this is that it works in partnership but not dependent upon NIC teaming for this to work. So you have access to SMB multi-channel with a single NIC that's out there if you wanted to. So for full throughput, basically, the bandwidth aggregation can happen across multiple NICs if they are of the same type and speed. And it also is able to go ahead and work across multiple CPU cores to reduce the bottleneck at the CPU for processing all this multi-channels that's out there, provided it's going to be using receive side scaling, or RSS. You're able to do automatic failover as well, again, automatically in the background. And as I mentioned, it does leverage NIC teaming if it's available, but is not dependent upon NIC teaming for it to be there. The best thing about this is that it's really completely behind the scenes. You just have to know that it's there from an architectural perspective for how to make this work. So in essence, if I have multiple NICs on my system, client or server perspective, I plug them into the same subnet prior to 2012, that wouldn't work unless you team them together with 2008R2. Now it does. Even from a client perspective, my system back at work actually has two NICs, and I have them plugged into the same network to make sure that I've got better throughput when I'm doing big file copies, that sort of stuff, off my servers. When you have multiple 1-gig NICs, it's going to go off and intelligently try to open up multiple sessions across those two different NICs that are out there. They don't even have to be in a team. If they are in a team, what you get with the third box over is the resiliency of the resilient nature of a NIC failure can allow it to go off and continue to work. And then finally, with RDMA, the interesting part about RDMA, it basically bypasses the processing level and goes straight through to the hardware acceleration of what's out there. Extra capabilities basically come into play. Now, what this looks like from a processor perspective, with SMB multi-channel in the old days, how this works, basically you have one session without multi-channel. You're looking at absolutely no failure that's possible that can take place. You can't really use the full 10 gigabits that are out there because you're going to basically max out with your TCP throughput on a single connection. And there's only going to be one CPU core that's activated to talk to that TCP session coming into your server, so you're going to end up with a bottleneck. You're not really going to get the full 10 gig E on that Ethernet connection that's out there. When you move this over to multi-channel, in other words, you start using a multi-channel capable client and a multi-channel capable server, that's when you start to do some really cool stuff with multiple sessions. There again still isn't any failover because it's single NIC, but now you're going to be able to achieve that full 10 gigabits throughput on your system because it's no longer a CPU bottleneck or a protocol bandwidth issue with TCP connections only having one because you open up multiple ones. How you configure this? Plug in your NIC, plug in your NIC in your server, and you're done. There's not much else you have to worry about. It's all just there. An example of real world of how this works that's even better. Recently, part of my job, besides coming up and talking, is I make content, demos, session content, that sort of stuff, available out to people around the world that are part of Microsoft. So basically we had to distribute 60 gigs of data out to about 70 different people across the world. We had a distribution server that was in Microsoft that's an older system running clustered shared volumes and 2008 R2. And it had a couple different NICs. Wasn't using teaming, but it's 2008 R2. And we put the 60 gigs up there for people to download. And just because I was a little paranoid because I was leaving for Auckland and Australia that day, I decided to set up a little copy process of my own from that server to my local server in my office, which is running server 2012, which is a standard white box $700 PC that's really a server, that's not really a server, with a single 1 gig Ethernet card in there and some crappy hard drives, but it's running server 2012. And I made a share available. I sent out the email to everybody to say, here's your primary source to get it from with the main server, and here's a backup location in case you can't get access to that one, and then here's some other stuff you can use in the cloud if you wanted to. Jeffa called me up and said, Rick, you gotta help me out. I'm copying down this stuff from the main server, and it's taking forever. And I'm at the main data center here in Microsoft and trying to copy stuff down. It's taking forever. And he's using a Windows 8, or maybe even was a server 2012 client to be able to do it. I said, well, here, try this backup one that I have in my office. You know, it might not be the most stable of systems. I can't guarantee it's going to be up. But go ahead and copy the content down from there. He was able to copy that content in under 60 minutes across the WAN link because he was using an SMB3 compatible client, Windows 8/Server 2012. And the server he was talking to was a Server 2012 box that also understood SMB3, which meant that they could open up multiple channels across SMB to copy the file down. So he was getting 12 meg a second copying the files down as opposed to crap, which is what he was getting from the other server. Just as simple as going in and upgrading your clients and upgrading your servers to SMB3, phenomenal throughput that you're now going to have to open this sort of stuff up without really changing that much on the architectural hardware that's running this all switching stuff. So with SMB channel, when you have multiple NICs, how does this work? You still have with one session, without multi-channel, so the old way of doing things, you still don't have automatic failover. You can't use the full bandwidth that's there as before. You can only have one NIC engaged, and only one CPU core is going to be engaged as well. So you're going to have, you know, okay but mediocre results that are possible. Now when you go in with one session with multi-channel that are out there, you'll have automatic failover without teaming. You don't have to have teaming involved for this. You'll have automatic failover if one of those NICs goes down because the sessions are simply going to be opened up on the other side. And you also get an aggregated bandwidth or combined bandwidth possible from both of those NICs that are coming across because all the NICs are engaged and all the cores on the box are engaged with this SMB process. Very, very fast stuff. Now, in case you don't know, the client is very important. The client negotiates when it makes the connection for the SMB connection. It negotiates, I understand multiple channels, do you? And if the server doesn't, it just ignores that question and only opens up the one channel. If it does, it then goes in and negotiates, these are the channels I'll have open for you, and here we go, let's get started, to simplify it. Now, in this case, we did some tests with performance on this, and you had SMB clients scaling with one NIC, two NIC, three NICs, and four NICs to be able to take a look at this. This was on the developer preview, so this is way old numbers and stuff that's out there. And you see that really, you don't get your performance gains with small amounts of transfer. You get your performance gains obviously with very large amounts of transfer because the more channels you can open up, the more lanes in the highway you can have open up, and the faster the data will come down to your individual system. And you can see here that it is leveraging the receive side scaling that's out there, and it also is available as a white paper to be able to go off and download to be able to talk about your throughput that's out there. The neat thing I like about this is you can see a very predictable level of increased performance as you add another NIC, as you add another NIC, and as you add another NIC, where the performance goes, when you're talking about the number of I/O transactions that are happening. So very predictable, very nicely done, and it just works out of the box. Now when you start combining SMB and multi-channel, as well as with NIC teaming, you can see here we now have the NIC teaming interface across it. Again, in the old way of doing things, you do have the automatic NIC failover, but you still have that bandwidth constriction because you're only having one core engaged on that server. When you start doing with multi-channel, you now have the automatic failover, And it's even faster, as you saw with my system, how fast my NIC teaming failover was. It's now even faster as well to recover. And the combined bandwidth available is now there as well. So this is your optimal environment to be able to have resilient nature of networks and also better throughput on your systems. Now, SMB Direct and SMB Multichannel, this is your RDMA stuff. When you're working with it, basically, you have automatic NIC failover, you have the combined bandwidth available, all the NICs are engaged, but then you have multiple RDMA connections. This is your ultimate place to go when you're talking about accessing your storage that's out there. The red lines basically means that you've now bypassed the software stack that's involved, and you're now going and offloading this directly to the actual hardware that's on the system, your Mellanox controllers, your RDMA controllers, and that sort of stuff. It basically will keep your TCP connection open for failback and fallback while it establishes the RDMA connection in the background. So that little dotted line in the middle is there only if the RDMA connection fails. It'll then go over and use the regular interfaces to be able to do this. Now, an interesting thing with multi-channel, where it doesn't apply for different things. Basically, when you start mixing and matching your speeds, SMB multi-channel will basically prioritize and find the fastest way to get to the data and only use that. So if you've got a 10 gig Ethernet interface and a 1 gig Ethernet interface and you have them both plugged into the same environment, SMB multi-channel is going to know that it's going to get better throughput on the 10 gig E and make all of its multiple sessions across the 10 gig E. You're not going to have your failover. SMB client, same thing. And obviously it does not work over wireless. It just simply prioritizes working over top of your preferred and fastest path. Same thing with RDMA offloads and that sort of stuff. Absolutely does not work with wireless. A little bit of a wrap-up summary here from a channel perspective, what makes the best option, the best iteration of this. A single NIC with no receive-side scaling. It works for throughput, but not very much. When you have multiple NICs, you now have better with SMB with some fault tolerance level. Optimally, you're going to be wanting to work with your multiple NICs in a team for your failover and for your bandwidth to go through. One last slide for troubleshooting. There's some PowerShell commands to take a look at, and obviously the event log for where it goes. Now, from a demo perspective, I'm challenged again by saying, okay, well, how can I explain this? How can I show this in some way that's going to be slightly meaningful for what's possible? You saw me establish a NIC team in my virtualized environment that's there. And from a throughput perspective, as you know, they're virtualized adapters, right? Just from a copy perspective, I've got my Ethernet adapter that's up and running, which in this case here is my Gold Coast virtualized team that's running. I also have my regular adapter as well that I'm connected up with for management purposes. And I'm going to go in. This is my WSS server that's there. And I'm going to go in and copy over a big amount of data to this guy from one of my other systems. It's also virtualized. Where did I put it? Big chunk O files. So we got 19 gigs of data inside this guy. This is my server that I just showed you just a minute ago. I'm going to go in and paste 19 gigs of files up to this guy to be able to go through and bring them up. Going back to this guy for both the team, performance-wise. You'll see that basically both of my NICs do have traffic on them. I'm not going to be able to actually get my throughput of showing you the maximum throughput of 10 gig through my virtualized environment as far as the copy process is going. But you'll basically see that both of my NICs are actively engaged. And it's copying the files over quite nicely, evenly distributing the load to be able to get it across. And it's up and going. How do I know it's going to be using SMB multi-channel? Because it's by default on the option, and I meet the criteria of having the same speed NICs, and I meet the criteria of having the client that supports SMB3, and the server that supports SMB3 as well. And it's going to be faster than if I had a single NIC on this particular virtualized interface. That's about the best demo I could try to come up with for being able to show you this. on a single system, meaning I'm copying some files over. In this case, I'm getting 300 megabits per second on average for this level here, and it spikes up and comes down again for where it goes. And he's just going to sit there and copy over and spike up every once in a while on both sides. While that's running, just for kicks, if I go in here and actually, oh, my NIC team interface is not responding. Let's come in here to my Hyper-V information, to this guy, and choose one of those network adapters and say, disconnect them. User error. Coming back into my team interface. Copy process. Still chugging along. I had the user error of someone even going into the NIC team and yanking the cable out of the back of that interface, and things kept on chugging along without any major interruption in service to my individual end users for stuff coming down. And then if my team interface management console, he's still locked up. I was going to show you here that one of them down below is inactive because it's disconnected, but it was still working. That's it for my SMB demo. SMB multi-channel demo. Again, if you haven't already, make sure you go off and take a look and review the SMB 3 session that happened yesterday. Very good stuff in there. This was simply a little touch at the architecture level for what's supported. Some other stuff, why they have storage. They left my resources for my last slide deck in here, so ignore these. What's more important is that obviously evaluations are available. Make sure you fill them out. You get a wonderful Bluetooth mouse you can now go off and support and get and have access to. Don't forget, as I mentioned in my previous session, be kind on the evaluations. Us foreigners have to have very high standards to be able to come back. I really enjoyed coming off and talking with you guys. I'd like to come back again to continue to talk with you guys. All the available resources will be available from australia.msteched.com/techedresources for downloads for the slides. You have access to all these slides if you're interested, and the recordings as well. Oh, yeah. There's a change in the schedule. I don't know why I get to announce this. There is a change in the schedule that happened that used to be called Inside the New Hyper-V. That one there was canceled. The replacement one is WSV-326A, which is known as What You Need to Know to Successfully Recover Active Directory. Sounds very interesting. Pete, are you doing that one, Mr. Active Directory? Pete Calvert? Pete Calvert, stop talking to your neighbor. Are you doing this one? Are you doing it? No, you're not doing it. Okay. It's still good. You should still go see this one, even though it's not Pete. This one, there you go. There is a very interesting one. I'm glad to see that you wore your good dress-up clothes for this interview panel. You're wearing a T-shirt, my friend. There is a panel at lunchtime if you're interested in Level 1 Fourier-E, where Seamus, the CNET editor, is going to be doing some interviews with a bunch of different people, Ben Armstrong, Pete Calvert, Sam, and Erdal, talking about server room horror stories, right? Cool stuff. Make sure you mention the network teaming and cabling issue and storage. Both of my sessions, mention them in there. They'll be good. The helicopter rides are back on again. If you want to, go off and tweet, I want to ride #WinServeHeli at AUTechEd, because come up with a good explanation. I was, again, reminded last night by the individual that's running this that I am not eligible to come. Even if you win and you say you want to bring me along, I'm not allowed to go. So enjoy the ride. It looks like a lot of fun. And with that, I have the ability to take a couple of questions, to talk about SMB multi-channel, to talk about NIC teaming. If questions are not on your mark and you'd like to go off and get a faster line than coffee, by all means, you're welcome to depart. Thank you very much, everybody. I still have 3 lovely maple syrup for questions, and also T-shirts to give away if you have any. Pardon me? Yes, sir. Yeah, so the question was, with switch independent NIC teaming, which network interface is the default inbound that comes in? And the answer is the first switch, so the first NIC that you chose as your default. When you create the team, you have the option of changing that. Once it's locked in, you can't change it unless you break the team and recreate it again. Be able to do it. You won yourself a maple syrup, my friend, and a T-shirt. Do you have a blue one already? There you go. You got the lucky limited edition blue. It's up there. Yes, sir. Top of the stairs. The IP address, first, same as the first NIC. When the team is established, all the NICs go offline, and then they come online as the new team. The first NIC for inbound traffic basically is going to be receiving the IP address, and they all basically share it from that point forward. So yes, it is the same address. Even if you had three statically configured, it actually wipes those addresses out when it makes the team, and it now is the new interface that has to have that single address that you either hard code or that you receive through DHCP. You don't statically assign addresses to your team because they all need to function under one IP address. So when you make your team. Yeah. Oh, when you have three configured, does it pick up the first? The answer is no. It literally goes in as if it's a brand new NIC that's unconfigured. So you want to immediately configure it with an IP address. If you want to come all the way down, I'll give you a maple syrup and a t-shirt for you, too. Do you want a black one or a blue one?
Black.
There you go, sir. Yes, sir. The question is basically, when you're looking at evaluating going with the vendor-provided one or going with the one that's now included here inside the operating system, do you lose any goodies? The biggest goodie that you lose is using the vendor-provided NIC is you lose PSS support. You don't have support for Microsoft PSS services if you're using a vendor-provided NIC. You have to go to the vendor, and they work between Microsoft and themselves to be able to provide you that level of support. As far as functionality for what's available on the teams, for the most part, most NIC teaming software just allows you to select how you want to do your failover, identifying your hot spares, and then also how you want to do your aggregation of bandwidth and control of your algorithm for that. You have all that functionality inside PowerShell interface and through the GUI interface. So really, not really that much. The biggest thing you're gaining by going with the OS level is full support for the entire stack. And the best thing about this, it also works with new technologies as they come online and as they have support for drivers, they'll be supporting NIC teaming, whereas you don't know with a third-party vendor. Come on down and get yourself a maple syrup, my last one. Want a blue or black or red? A black. I'm just going to go over here for this side. You're not wearing your Jeep t-shirt today, sir. It's dirty. Yes. Is there any benefit making a team as iSCSI target? Yeah, you're basically going to be able to get the fault-tolerant nature of it, and that's about it. There's no other problem. The nice thing about this is, again, it's independent of the workload for what's supported. As long as it's inside the OS, this team is established. The other applications and workloads above it all work. No real performance benefits over it. Well, you will have, you know, one inbound channel and then multiple outbound. So, yeah, you will have some better performance. But there's other ways of doing it instead of using iSCSI. Yes, sir, right next to you. Okay, yes. When you have switch-dependent teaming for your design, are you able to have plug it into multiple different switches for redundancy? And the answer is absolutely yes. It is supported. There's a list inside my deck of the different protocols specifically, but it's using industry standard switching technology that it used and has already been using for a while. 802.1 something or other, it's in my deck. But yes, it does support the industry standard protocols that are there. The challenge is that you have to architect all of your inbound traffic management across those switches. So obviously you already have a big understanding of the network architecture to do that, to make it all work. The downside of that is, again, is obviously if the switch physical hardware fails, that guy's dead and done. Whereas if you weren't using switch-dependent teaming, it would simply go off and continue to function as it would. So there is a downside to it as well. That's just an architecture choice. I ignored this side over here. I'm going to be coming back to the gentleman in the red striped shirt. If you lose the primary NIC, does the whole thing reconfigure and it's all there? Everything still continues to function because all NICs are functioning as if they have the same address. The inbound traffic will be rerouted by the OS to another NIC that's out there. what's going to happen as a downside is if you happen to associate a VLAN specifically with a NIC for traffic, segregation, bringing the traffic in, that particular VLAN is going to be down because the NIC interface is down. You have to reconfigure it. Or it's going to fall over to your default catch-all environment that's there. Good? Up in the back. Is it going to be what, sorry? Okay. Is SMB3 going to be backported to previous clients? I don't have visibility into that at this point in time. All I know is that it is available for current clients, which is running Windows 8 and Server 2012. I'm not aware of any plans on the product team side of things, if they're going to be back patching it or not. Unfortunately, I can't share any other information with you. I got a t-shirt for you if you want. Come on down for a t-shirt. Technically, I have 5 minutes left, guys, before I get kicked off the stage, so I'm still here. I got to go back over this side. Yes, sir, in the stripes. Hyper-V switch manager to be able to do that. Okay, the question was basically with SRIOV technology with teaming, how does it go ahead and do this inside the virtual switch? Because basically what you're doing is you're adding in an SRIOV adapter inside the VM, which doesn't offload down to the actual NIC itself for better throughput. When you establish an SRIOV NIC team within the VM, what you're doing is you're giving it a level of failover that it wouldn't have, because it would be dependent upon the single connection down. So the team really is only for a failover option in case that NIC happens to go down. So it's at the OS level within the VM guest, and then you do the team inside the VM guest against two SRIOV virtual adapters that you've added into your system. And it handles it in case one happens, the physical adapter happens to go down, it's mapped down to the physical adapter on the system. That's why you have to do teaming for SRIOV inside the guest, because it's abstracted from when it hits the team level down below in the outside world. So that's how you would set it up. It really is just like I did there, the same way that you make a NIC, the difference being that you have to add in under the settings of the virtual machine an SRIOV adapter as opposed to my generic network adapter that's in there. Yes, sir.
I have two questions. First question,
I only have one t-shirt for you, though.
What's the best brand of Canadian maple syrup? Is it Camp or Queen or Maple Leaf? And which one do you use? And the second one is the SMB protocol. Has it been published? I have to do a lot of work between Linux and Windows Server.
Yeah. Okay. First question is, I'm actually biased with my maple service, my maple syrup choices. He was asking about my maple syrup choices of choice. I prefer the Atlantic maple syrup, which is from New Brunswick, because that's where I'm from. The big maple syrup heist that happened was in Quebec, so it didn't affect us in the Maritimes. You can't actually buy that one unless you're in New Brunswick. You can buy the generic stuff, which is Quebec. They've cornered the market for the international record of maple syrup. Now, as far as the other question for SMB3 related to this session, is it going to be available for other people? Are we working with the industry that's the SMB environment? And the answer is yes, we are working with them. And these are standards that are published for them to be able to use. And potentially, as you mentioned, in time, you will see SMB3 for other OSs that are out there. So we play nicely with the standards bodies, and have been for a while, and we're now starting to see the fruits of our labors for playing nicely with the standards bodies. SMB3 is no different. It's good. I'm going to wrap it up because my throat's kind of tired. If you want to still ask some questions, you're welcome to come down and to chat with me down here. But thank you very much for sticking around. You got 5 minutes back of your life.